name is Tom Witt, and the session tonight is entitled Explosion into the Nuclear Age, the decision to drop the atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I realize that it's a little less than a week early for this session. Apologize that the time is not quite right, but I assume that most of you will not be here next week, and as I will not be here next week. But I hope that perhaps some of the information that I share you can be thinking about as Hiroshima and Nagasaki Day, the 40th anniversary, approaches. But I do think that to know a little bit about the background, the decisions, the events leading up to the dropping of the bomb, the decisions that were being made 40 years ago, this month and beginning of next month, I think it's quite important to have some of that background, and I'll try to present historically some of the factual information and also raise some questions as to what the implications are for us today. I give thanks at the beginning to a couple of different people for some of the information. One would be Mark Schwain, professor of American Studies in Chicago, and also Professor James Farrell from St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. Also several books that I was able to read, The Atomic Bomb, The Critical Issues, edited by Barton Bernstein, and a new book out just this year, Day One, Before Hiroshima and After, by Peter Wyden. And also I would turn your attention to, I actually ran across this after preparing for this session, but the newest Sojourners magazine has a spread on the Hiroshima decision that is a good short summary if you want to read over that. It is the foreword of a book by Gar Alperovitz, and it's called Atomic Diplomacy, his book.
What issue is that?
That is the August-September 1985 edition of Sojourners. As I said, I want to give some background. I'll try to do that historically. That means in chronological order. Please feel to interrupt me if you need some clarification. But I would like to kind of get through my outline, and then we'll open it up for some discussion. I'm going to start a little bit earlier than one might expect, talking about the Hiroshima bomb. I'm going to start in 1805. And excuse me, I'll give you just a little bit of physics, and you don't have to worry because I don't know very much, so it won't be very long. But start with the discovery of the atom in 1805. And atom, which is a Greek word, means indivisible. And in the same way that people would divide the indivisible, the atomic bomb, I think, undermines many previous assumptions of human history. As it happens, the atom is not actually indivisible, but has three parts, as many of you know. The electron, which are negatively charged particles, the protons that are positively charged and gathered around the nucleus, the center of the atom, and neutrons that are neutral particles that are also gathered in the center of the atom. Just very briefly, I think it's important to describe a little bit about how that atom gets turned into an atomic bomb. Both the proton and neutron are heavier parts of the atom, weighing about 2,000 times the weight of the electron. And there's a tremendous amount of force in the nucleus of that atom. Each element has an equal number of protons, electrons. There's some of this clicking back, or the cobweb sort of coming out from physics class in high school. An equal number of protons and electrons, ranging from, in the natural order of things, from hydrogen with one of each, to uranium with 92 of each, and these elements can have varying numbers of neutrons, and each varying number of neutrons creates what is called an isotope. Isotopes have a different atomic weight. In other words, they have different numbering of protons and neutrons. For instance, uranium-235 has 92 protons and 143 neutrons. That's the element that was used for the explosive force. What is the force in an atom? The force in an atom is the attraction between positive protons and negative electrons, but greater is the force that keeps those positively charged protons together in the nucleus, because they would want to repel each other in the nucleus of the atom. So thus, the real force of the atom is literally nuclear, the energy which binds the nucleus together. Now, the heavier elements like radium and uranium are so unstable that they're not found in nature. By unstable, we mean that every once in a while they will fire off part of the nucleus to reach a more stable form, and thus releasing a huge amount of energy which had bound those particles in place. So it was thought then that if the nucleus of a heavy element could be split in two or more fragments, it would release a great amount of energy. And this is what Einstein figured out with his theory of relativity equals mc squared. Energy equals the mass times speed of light squared. Or another way to put it, the loss of a particle of the nucleus is balanced by a tremendous amount of energy. Does that confuse people, or does that help a little bit? The loss of mass, or the loss of a nuclear particle, has to be balanced out by a release of a huge amount of energy. That was in 1905. But at that point, Einstein didn't even know that atoms had protons and neutrons and electrons. And even after the neutron was discovered in 1932, he didn't think that his theory of relativity had any practical application. But in 1938, two scientists at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin split an atom using a neutron and an unstable nucleus that rearranged itself. And this was, of course, a tremendous step forward, because now it was thought that if you got the right amount of materials together, assembled them, free neutrons might create what's called a chain reaction, which could produce a very large release of energy, as much as 200 million volts of electricity. I mentioned chain reaction. I think that's an important word in more ways than one. A chain reaction occurs in physics as uranium fires off neutrons in the process of splitting, which then split other atoms. And I tried to put a little bit of a diagram up here on the board of a free neutron coming at and splitting a nucleus at a great speed. And then a great amount of energy is released along with some gamma rays, fragments, and then other neutrons. And then other neutrons then proceed to split other atoms. And this kind of, under the right conditions, this kind of growth can increase at a fantastic rate, so that you have 2, 4, 16, and they keep on going. After a while, an astronomical number of fissions can be produced. And if that process continues, the corresponding energy release then is so great that it could just blow the whole system apart. And this is actually what happens. It's similar to how nuclear energy works, but nuclear energy is more controlled and more efficient. But the atom bomb is actually, and has been called, uncontrolled nuclear energy. Just in a split second, millions and millions of fissions occur, just a fraction of a second. So in 1938, the atom is split in Germany, but they did not achieve a chain reaction at this point. In 1939, then, there were some atomic scientists in Germany worried that Hitler and the Nazis could create the atomic bomb. They migrated to America and eventually got Albert Einstein to write to Franklin Delano Roosevelt to get government support for nuclear research to beat Germany to the bomb. It was feared that Germany would be able to build the bomb quicker than the United States. So the bomb, as we know, led to an arms race, but it also emerged out of an arms race with the Germans. Okay, 1941, in December, as you know, the United States entered the war in response to the attack on Pearl Harbor. But the day before, the decision had been made to build an atomic bomb, even though it wasn't known whether this was possible or not. But in late 1942, just a year later, another breakthrough was made that convinced scientists that it would be possible. The first self-sustaining nuclear chain reaction was experimentally proved using uranium-235, and the scientist's name was Enrico Fermi, and all this took place beneath Stagg Field at the University of Chicago, of course, with great danger to the civilian population of Chicago, but not that many people knew what was going on at that point. From that point on, when the chain reaction was achieved, the bomb was no longer an issue of science, but just one of technology. How quickly could it be done? And I think here it's important that we recall the image of the chain reaction that I used at the beginning. In an atomic reaction, once the elements have been brought together, they run through a series of chain reactions until the final explosion takes place. And I think so too, in a similar way, Once it was discovered that the atomic bomb was possible, so too the elements of our society acted and reacted. Decisions were being made at an uncontrollable rate until the bomb exploded over Hiroshima. So I'd like for us to keep in mind that image of the chain reaction, the chain of events that led to what I think is the inevitable dropping of the Hiroshima bomb, because I think there were two different kinds of chain reactions going on, one on a physical level and one on a social political level. So keep that in mind as we talk. But from that point on, 1942, it was not a matter of science but a matter of technology. They knew the bomb was possible. But there's still a lot of work to be done. First of all, the main obstacle was trying to get enough of the uranium-235 out of the more abundant 238, and then also getting plutonium out of U-238. And thirdly, designing a bomb that could be triggered in the air and that would split enough nuclei to sustain a nuclear chain reaction. And for this, they needed hundreds and hundreds of scientists, engineers, and processing plants to develop nuclear materials. So 1942 put in charge of the whole project, which is now called the Manhattan Project because it was decided upon when people were in Manhattan. A man in charge is General Leslie Groves, who he had been the person who has said to have built the Pentagon on the words, "When in doubt, act." When he took over, from then on, $1 billion a year would be spent on nuclear research and construction of the bomb. And that was $1 billion in 1942 dollars. So it gives you a sense of the size of the project. A couple of interesting things about the Manhattan Project. It was one of the first times that there was federal funding for scientific research. Everything that was done, the government paid for. Secondly, there was strict compartmentalization of knowledge. In other words, hardly anyone knew what was going on. There were kind of invisible walls of separation between research departments, and maybe only one person was allowed to talk to another person from another department. So many people worked on different parts of the bomb without really knowing what the whole thing was. I think it was just about a dozen people out of the eventually, I think it was 150,000 people that worked on the Manhattan Project. Only a dozen people were eventually allowed to see an overall plan of what they were working on. Along with the strict compartmentalization of knowledge was supreme secrecy. Congress appropriated more than $2 billion for a project that they knew nothing about. Questions were finally raised in 1945, but Secretary of War Stimson gave his word of honor that publicity would hurt national security, so Congress never did find out what they were funding. There were security checks for all workers who were spied upon. They got censored mail with words cut out. If some of the workers wrote letters that the government did not like, they would get them right back. The closest relatives to workers were not even allowed to know where they were working. That's how secretive it was. Telephone conversations were bugged, etc. Several new towns were created because of the project. Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and also a town close by here, Hanford, Washington, the plutonium works, was created because of the Manhattan Project. In Hanford, they paved an 8-lane highway for evacuation because of not knowing what might happen at the plant. They used TV monitors in those days for the process. People had to wear plastic lenses to cover their eyes because the whole process darkened regular glass. So from 1942 to 1945, the work moved very quickly because the project had almost a blank check, and moved quickly also because of the use of IBM computers. Eventually, the project was consolidated when the United States bought the Los Alamos Boys Ranch in near Alamogordo, New Mexico, for central research and development. A man by the name of Robert Oppenheimer became the director, although he almost did not get clearance because of his leftist links. He had some friends and relatives who were members of the Communist Party. It brings us up to 1945, 40 years ago. On April 12th, of course, FDR died. And when Truman is sworn in, he does not know anything about the atomic bomb. That's how secret the project was. He does not hear about the bomb until April 26th, when he's finally briefed about it. The next important date to know is May 8th, which is VE Day, the war in Europe ends. And this changed the nature of the Manhattan Project, since we were no longer now in a race with the Germans. Scientists had constantly been under this pressure that they had to come up with the technology quickly because the Germans would drop the bomb on us first. But in reality, now we know that none of those assumptions about the Germans were true. We know that the United States secret agents knew as early as November of 1944 that the Germans were almost 3 years behind the United States in atomic research. Most of the great nuclear physicists in Germany had left by that time, and it seems that Hitler did not have that good a rapport with the scientists who were there. And it seems ironic that the physicists who were still in Germany, for the most part, by and large, obeyed their consciences and were attempting to prevent the construction of the atomic bomb in Germany. Scientists living under dictatorship were trying to prevent the construction of this awful weapon, while their counterparts in America, living under democracy, were spending, with very few exceptions, were concentrating almost their whole effort on building the atomic bomb. So now that there was no longer this supposed German threat, the Manhattan Project changed, but it still continued, as by now that chain reaction that I talked about continued. The project had developed a logic and an impetus all its own. And again, at this point, one has to ask whether or not we were really in control, even at that point, with technology unleashed without reason. Few people asked questions about why the building of the bomb was going on. Few people really knew what was going on. There were a couple of scientists who, at this point, after the war in Germany ended, who protested further research and of the bomb, and the response of FDR and the Truman administration was that science and morality and politics could be separated, and that scientists should really refrain from political and moral judgments. That so there no longer, not only was there compartmentalization of knowledge, but compartmentalization of responsibility. Scientists were specialists who did their work, and they did not think about how to use the weapons that they created. Years after Hiroshima, Robert Oppenheimer would say, I quote, "When you see something that is technically sweet, you go ahead and you do it, and you argue about what to do about it only after you've had your technical success." That was the way it was with the atomic bomb. You note the short-sightedness of that statement, that after the bomb was proved possible, only generals and politicians argued about what to do about it, and not the scientists. Their job was only to make it. And unless we think that that is somewhat strange, I think it's comparable to much of our work today, where I think that our notion of vocational responsibility is very limited to being to work on time and being honest on the job and not getting involved in any financial or sexual scandals or maybe having a good personal Christian witness. But I don't think very many of us are very good at thinking about the consequences of our work. If you ever see the movie The Day After Trinity, and I would encourage some of you who are going home this weekend to check in your TV guides, it may be on PBS this next week. The Day After Trinity is a story of Robert Oppenheimer and the Manhattan Project, and it's very, very well done. And it shows scientists struggling now with their work in the Manhattan Project some 30, 40 years later. And I think it's Oppenheimer's brother who says, "Finally, we just wanted to see if it worked." And that's what it was, is they wanted to see if their technology would actually carry out what they had created. Dr. Leo Szilard, who was one of the scientists who did have reservations at that time, I have a quote from him. "During 1943 and part of 1944, our greatest worry was the possibility that Germany would perfect an atomic bomb before the invasion of Europe. In 1945, when we ceased worrying about what the Germans might do to us, we began to worry about what the United States might do to other countries." Okay, in July, President Truman now is headed for a conference called the Potsdam Conference, just outside of Berlin, and it's a debate of some diplomatic issues concerning Europe and Japan with Stalin and Churchill. And as he's on his way to the conference, he's taking a ship over. This is about July 12th or 13th now. Truman is on a ship going to Europe. That time in the war, we had already broken the Japanese communication codes. So we had invaded had control of Japanese airspace. And the United States intercepted a message from Japan as Japan was contacting Russia. Russia, or the Soviet Union at that time, was neutral toward Japan. And the Japanese were sending signals that they were anxious to end the war. Continuation would only aggravate problems, and that they were anxious to end the war. And these kind of peace feelers had been happening since the end of 1944, but the Secretary of Navy described these cables in July as real evidence that the Japanese wanted to get out of the war. Incidentally, now, just since 1979, that the public has had some access to some of these intercepted cables. Some of them are still in the National Archives and not available for the public to look at. But the message was intercepted that Japan would like to end the war. If, though, Japan would be forced into unconditional surrender, Japan would be forced to fight to the end. And they held this all the way through. It's very interesting that the sovereignty of the Emperor of Japan was very important to them. And every time that the United States asked for unconditional surrender, they became more convinced that they would fight to the end, even though they knew they were losing. But at this point, it seemed that the one thing standing in the way of surrender was the demand for unconditional surrender by the United States. Well, President Truman on the ship ignored the peace feeler, and later at Potsdam he would call again for total Japanese unconditional surrender. I think we have to recognize that we dropped the bomb on Japan after they had started negotiations for an end of to the war, but we did not wait for those negotiations with the Soviet Union to continue, and we demanded unconditional surrender. We dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and we settled for conditional surrender in the end. Japan was allowed to retain the emperor's sovereignty. So I think that's one indication that Japan was willing to talk before the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. I'll come back to that again. Yeah.
What kind of negotiations were taking place before the drone?
It was very informal. It was first of all feelers, and then some direct communication between Russian diplomats or Soviet diplomats and Japanese military people. Also, there were some discussions between some U.S. diplomats in Sweden at the time, and Japanese people, and also we'll find out later that the emperor directly intervened in late July and asked that negotiations begin. And all the time you'll find that the Japanese are very frustrated with the Soviet Union for not working harder at those negotiations. But they clearly had taken the initiative. I'll come back to that again. But on July 16th now, back in the United States, the first plutonium bomb is tested at Alamogordo, New Mexico. And I'd like to just read a couple things and for you to notice that some of the symbolic nature of it. Maybe I'm playing this up too much. The spot where the bomb would be detonated was called Point Zero at Jornado del Muerto, the Journey of Death in Spanish, near the village of Oscuro, or Darkness. But the code name for the whole area was called Trinity, a specific reference to the trinity of mass, energy, and the velocity of light, but also, I think, an implicit reference to the godlike powers of the people who had created the bomb. And I'll read a description of the test blast and written by a scientist who was there. And I think it has some religious and maybe apocalyptic overtones. He writes, "It was a blinding flash, a light not of this world, the light of many suns in one. It was a sunrise such as the world has never seen, a great green super sun climbing in a fraction of a second to a height of more than 8,000 feet, rising ever higher until it touched the clouds, lighting up earth and sky all around with a dazzling luminosity. Up it went, upward from deep purple to orange, expanding, growing bigger, rising as it was expanding. For a fleeting instant, the color was unearthly green, such as one only sees in the corona of the sun during the total eclipse. It was as though the earth had opened and the skies had split. One felt as though one had been privileged to witness the birth of the world, to be present at the moment of creation when the Lord said, "Let there be light." At the time of the blast, Robert Oppenheimer, the director of the program, quoted a phrase from the sacred epic of the Hindus, which you have on your sheet, "I am become death, shatterer of worlds." About 50 miles away, there was a blind girl who saw a great flash of light about 50 miles away from the blast. Some peoples were scorched, animals died. Later, their people's hair seemed to be falling out. The U.S. government released an AP wire because of some of these complaints that said that an ammunition depot had exploded, and there was not anything to worry about. Scientists had expected about 1,000 to 5,000 tons of TNT. Enrico Fermi was taking bets that it would ignite the atmosphere and possibly destroy the state of New Mexico. But actually, it was closer to 20,000 tons of TNT that exploded. And no one really knew what to expect. They were taking bets before the blast. A message then, after the successful test of the bomb, was coded then to Truman that said, "Operated on this morning, diagnosis not yet complete, but results seem satisfactory and already exceed expectations." That was on the 16th. Back at Potsdam now, Truman has received this message, and the United States and Britain now begin to first talk about how the bomb should be used. And notice I didn't say whether the bomb should be used, but how the bomb should be used. I want to focus for a bit on now what is called atomic diplomacy, which first started at this Potsdam meeting after Truman was notified of the successful testing of the bomb. Incidentally, Truman even postponed this meeting so that it would start after the bomb was tested. If you remember what we were told, not me, but those who were alive in 1945, the atomic bomb was used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki because it shortened the war and saved hundreds of thousands and maybe even millions of lives. That's what people are told, and I'm convinced that even up until the spring or maybe early summer of 1945, that even the Truman administration were convinced of that. But by July of 1945, there is much evidence now to the contrary that that was not the primary reason for thinking about dropping the bomb. What do I mean by that? Okay, first of all, the first planned land invasion of Japan at that time, which would incur large numbers of casualties, was the earliest planned land invasion was November 1st, a good 3 months away. And that invasion had an estimated 31,000 casualties, with a later invasion plan than for the spring of 1946, which could have incurred thousands and thousands of casualties. Reminder that comparatively not many had died yet, at least on the United States side, at least not in the millions. The number of lives lost in World War II for the United States was somewhere around 400,000, compared to the Soviet Union with 20 million, close to 20 million, and China probably even more than that. Secondly, when discussing the use of the bomb at Potsdam, there were some different options presented, the first of which was to just simply publicize the force of the bomb for people to react to. Secondly, was a possible test in a deserted area that would show the bomb's destructive capability. And thirdly, another option was a warning about the selected time and place so that people could be evacuated. Eventually, none of those obviously were used. A few of the admirals present thought that Japan should be forewarned. And Secretary of War Stimson said that the United States should first offer Japan surrender terms with the option of retaining their emperor, and then that the Japanese should be given warning of the bombs. But more interestingly now, we're aware years after that there were a number of high-ranking officials who thought the bomb was not needed at all. General Dwight Eisenhower, who was at Potsdam, was one of those, and I'll read Eisenhower's reaction upon hearing that the atomic bomb was to be used against the Japanese. He said, "I voiced my grave misgivings, first on the basis of my belief that Japan was already defeated and that dropping the bomb was completely unnecessary, and secondly, because I thought that our country should avoid shocking world opinion by the use of a weapon whose employment was, I thought, no longer mandatory as a measure to save American lives. In Eisenhower's judgment, Japan was, at that very moment, seeking some way to surrender with a minimum loss of face. And Eisenhower was not the only one to express that view that Japan was already defeated. Admiral William Leahy, a five-star admiral, the senior military officer of the United States, and also the chief of staff to the president, also thought that the weapon was of no material assistance in the war against Japan. The Japanese were already defeated, said Leahy, and ready to surrender because of the effective sea blockade and successful bombing with conventional weapons. You might remember that in the spring, Tokyo had been firebombed, which actually was more destructive in some ways than the Hiroshima bomb, although it took much longer. 200,000 people in Tokyo died, 500,000 were injured. General Curtis LeMay of the Air Force argued that the war could be ended by September or October without an invasion, without the use of the bomb. Henry Arnold, who was the Chief General of the Air Force, made a special point of reading into the record his judgment that Japan could be compelled into surrender within a month before the landing that was scheduled for November 1st. Finally, consider the words of Great Britain's Prime Minister Winston Churchill. Churchill said, "It would be a mistake to suppose that the fate of Japan was settled by the atomic bomb. Her defeat was certain before the first bomb fell." So you might ask, if the bomb was not used primarily to end the war with Japan and to save American lives, why would it have been used? And I think we have to look at another side of atomic diplomacy to answer that question, and I think that has to do with the Soviet Union. If you were at all a history student or remember your history, on May 8th, VE Day, when the war in Europe had ended, Stalin promised to enter the war with Japan in 3 months, which would be August 8th, and eventually Stalin kept his word. And it's interesting now to look at how the Truman administration viewed the Soviet declaration of war against Japan, which would again had a it would have had a devastating effect on the Japanese military, who wanted the Soviet Union to stay neutral. But for most of the war, the United States had been trying to get the Soviet Union to enter the war against Japan. But by now, it becomes evident that the United States wanted to keep the Soviet Union out of the war with Japan so that they would have no chance for political or territorial influence or interest in the Pacific. So not only did the U.S. no longer encourage the Soviet Union to participate in the war against Japan, it wanted to do everything possible to end the war before the Russians got in. So there's much information now to suggest that the primary reason for using the atomic bomb and using it as early as we did, the beginning of August, was not to save American lives, but that Truman was influenced by a desire to impress and intimidate the Russians. The administration knew that Japan was near collapse, and evidence now quite strongly indicates that perhaps Truman ignored the Japanese peace feelers because he knew about the bomb and its capacity to keep the Russians in line. Secretary of State Burns wrote in his journal that the bomb was perceived as a sign to the Russians to keep them out of the Japanese theater, to make them more manageable in Europe by showing them we were willing to use this force and also willing to use it when it was not militarily necessary. Burns' argument was not that it was militarily necessary. He believed that Japan would capitulate, especially with the Russian declaration of war. Burns was quoted as saying, "It never occurred to me not to use the bomb." So I think we have to think that, we have to at least consider now that more than a last-ditch effort to end the war and to save American lives, the bomb was a strong signal to the Russians to keep them in line and to make them more manageable in Europe. So as a result, the decisions made at the Potsdam Conference were that first, the bomb would be used against the Japanese as soon as possible. Secondly, that it would be used on a dual target, meaning a military target surrounded by lots of civilians and homes. And thirdly, it would be used without prior warning. Never in any of the discussions at Potsdam, before or after Potsdam, was the question raised about whether or not the bomb should be used, but only when and how. And there may have been some other factors at work. I don't want to just narrowly say that those were the reasons the bomb were dropped. Some did claim that there was a military justification for the bomb. They saw the bomb as no different than any other weapon, like a conventional weapon, and that you use any weapon necessary to win a war. And so they never saw the bomb as anything new. Some saw it as militarily necessary. I think also many did not see the bomb had an impetus of its own, I think. It was out of control. The bomb, I think, was dropped partly because of the momentum it had already gathered. The research had been done, it was possible, and we've rarely discovered anything that we haven't used. So some go so far as to say that the reason the bomb was dropped is because we had already spent the money. Billions of dollars had been used, and it would have been embarrassingly difficult to justify why we spent all that money and then never used the product. I think it was also an emotional decision. People were tired after 6 years of war, 4 years of U.S. participation. And I also think we have to at least consider that there might have been some implicit racism. I ask the question, would we have bombed a European country in the same way? Those are at least some of the reasons, I think, that we can cite for the bombing. So anyway, at this time, Truman has talked to Churchill about the different possibilities of using the bomb. And at this time, it's also very important to know that he did not talk to Stalin about it at the Potsdam Conference. It came much later in the conference. I will just read a quotation from a member of the British delegation, Lord Moran, who, seeing Churchill's reaction to the success of the atomic weapon testing and America's determination to then use the bomb, he says this. This is a member of the British delegation. "I was deeply shocked by this ruthless decision to use the bomb on Japan. I knew it was hopelessly illogical. From bows and arrows to bullets and shells, and more shells, and yes, to a torpedo that might send 1,000 men to the bottom of the sea. Finally, to an atomic bomb. There could be no point when the process of destruction becomes immoral. It was all to no purpose. There had been no moment in the whole war when things looked to me so black and desperate, and the future looked so hopeless. I knew enough of science to grasp that this was only the beginning. Like the little bomb that fell outside my hut near some town in Europe in 1915 and made a hole in the ground the size of a wash basin. It was not so much the morality of the thing, but it was simply that the linchpin that had been underpinning the world had become half wrenched out. I thought of my boys." Admiral Rowan came into the room, and I found myself listening to his conversation with the Prime Minister as when one hears the voices around, as one going under an anesthetic. Voices very far off and not like real people. I went out and wandered through the empty rooms. I once slept in a house where there had been a murder. I felt like that here. On July 25th, while Truman was still at Potsdam, the United States intercepted yet another message between Japan and the Soviet Union. And this time, Japan asked the Soviet Union to ask the United States and Britain for surrender short of unconditional surrender. Asked for reasonable terms under the Atlantic Charter, wanted to end the hostility, but also wanted to secure and maintain Japan's nation's existence and honor. And should the U.S. and Britain insist on the formality of unconditional surrender, Japan had no choice but to fight on. And that was because of that one point, the recognition of the emperor. It's at that point that many people ask, not why the bomb was used, but why was it used so quickly? It becomes very clear that the bomb was not a last alternative. It was used very quickly, within a few days after it was ready, without first trying alternatives that might have rendered it unnecessary. For instance, following up those peace feelers, stepping up the conventional warfare, or modifying the surrender terms, or guaranteeing the position of the emperor, providing an explicit warning, or non-combat demonstration of the bomb, or waiting for the Soviets to enter the war, or at least declare that they would do so. But instead, on July 21st, Truman again called for unconditional surrender at the Potsdam Conference and ordered that the bombs would be readied. And it's interesting that both bombs were ordered, not just one. The official order directed that additional bombs will be delivered on the targets as soon as made ready. And that meant that
Two bombs could be dropped in early August and one in later August because only three would be ready in the next few weeks. Oppenheimer incidentally thought that there would probably be 12 or so bombs that would be required to make the Japanese surrender when he first started the project. Okay, at the end of the Potsdam Conference now, just before they're leaving, Truman finally tells Stalin about the bomb without using the word atomic, but he tells Stalin that the United States has some sort of destructive, great destructive weapon, and Stalin gives a very calm, relaxed response, something like, very good, I hope you use it in the Pacific soon. Stalin then returns and tells his delegation about the bomb, and his chief advisor responds, well, let them use it then. We'll have to talk it over with Kurchatov and get him to speed up our own research. Kurchatov was in charge of atomic research in the Soviet Union. And here are some comments by Marshal Zhukov from the Soviet Union, who was there. He writes in his journal, I realized that they were talking about research on the atomic bomb. Very few turning points in history can be specified precisely. When Rome began to decline, when it can be said to have fallen, when the Renaissance began, or even what the Renaissance was. All these questions become murky as they shade off into questions of precondition. But whether Stalin knew exactly what Truman was talking about that evening, or whether he only came to realize it later on, here is one point in history that can be dated with extraordinary precision. The 20th century nuclear arms race began at the Centennial Palace at 7:30 p.m. on July 25th, 1945. Russia's immediate reaction then was to speed up and match the U.S. and obtain nuclear parity. So I'd read that just in case you wondered where the arms race came from. Okay, for the last 8 or 9 months now, the Air Force Group, the 509th Composite Group, began practicing for the bomb run without knowing it. Some of them did not even know what they were doing until they were in the B-29 headed for Hiroshima. They practiced their bombing runs in the state of Utah for a while, then moved to an island called Tinian in the Pacific, where they did the same. They wore goggles when they practiced and practiced swooping flights up after they dropped their practice bombs. They swooped out of sight and were told never to look at the bomb site. And they were ridiculed by the other people on the base for this because the pilots had no idea why they were doing this, but they knew somehow it was secret and important. The bomb arrived on the island in parts to be assembled on the plane. And the first bomb that was dropped was an untested bomb. It was not the same kind of bomb that was tested in New Mexico. It was a uranium bomb named by the scientists Little Boy. The second bomb was a plutonium bomb that was tested and was called Fat Man. The bomb was ready for use on August 3rd, but because of weather conditions, it had to wait till August 6th. On the 5th, the pilot, Colonel Paul Tibbetts, christened the plane Enola Gay, named after his mother in the States. And finally, before the plane took off, at 12:15 a.m. on the 6th, a Lutheran chaplain led the prayer. And I had never known that before, and I read a book, and I have a portion of the prayer. He asked the crews to bow their heads as he sought heavenly assistance for their mission. Quote, we pray thee to be with those who brave the heights of thy heaven. Armed with thy strength, may they bring this war to a rapid end. Early morning on August 6th, the 1B-29 flew at very high altitude, 35,000 feet, and there were two other planes alongside for weather conditions, especially looking out for electrical storms. But carrying only one missile, the bomb exploded 8:16 a.m., local time, right on target. If any of you have been to Hiroshima and have gone to the Peace Museum, I had an opportunity to do that this spring. You will see watches there that have the time 8:16. They stopped right on the minute. The August 7th photo reconnaissance showed that 60% of the city was gone and estimated 70 to 80,000 dead, an equal number injured. The actual figures were more like 150,000 dead. And by now, in 1985, 200,000 have died because of the bombing. In May of 1945, Oppenheimer thought it may kill 20,000.
but 150,000 died immediately. The immediate effects, radiant heat from 100 million degrees Fahrenheit reached ground, setting people's clothes afire within half mile, trees afire at 1.5 miles, shock waves ruptured internal organs, people vomited blood, the blast blew bodies at 500 to 1,000 miles per hour through the air, gamma rays and atomic particles damaged blood cell production and caused wounds to bleed uncontrollably. Near ground zero, bodies disintegrated and only shadows remained. Again, if you ever are able to travel to Japan and see the Peace Museum, you'll see these that are ingrained into wood or cement, just the shadows of people, nothing else remains. The immediate response to the bomb, the things that were generally publicized through the media was the destruction wrought by the bomb, and secondly, the hope for the end of the war. And those of you who are older than me, you will remember the newspapers on the day after. Not emphasized generally or pretty much ignored were the political implications of the bomb or the moral implications. President Truman quoted upon hearing the news, "This is surely the greatest thing in history." The next thing he said upon entering a room full of U.S. officials, "Keep your seats, gentlemen. We have just dropped a bomb on Japan which has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. With an overwhelming success, we won the gamble." It was indeed a gamble, but President Truman had not realized that gamble had just begun. Again, when you look at the quotations of the politicians and the scientists, you'll notice a difference. And on your sheet, there's two quotes together, one by Harry Truman and one by Albert Einstein. And it's interesting that Truman uses the word harnessing of the basic power of the universe, and Albert Einstein uses the word unleashed power of the atom. The politicians constantly think that we're in control, and the scientists increasingly think that things are out of control. On August 8th, the Soviet Union declares war, and August 9th in the morning, the Japanese have received this message, and as the cabinet is meeting, the prime minister suggests agreeing to or at least talking about unconditional surrender. 1 minute later, the bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, killing 70,000 people. Incidentally, Nagasaki was the secondary target that day. The primary target was Kokura, and the bomb run went over 3 times, and because of cloud cover, were not able to bomb Kokura and only had enough gas for one more run and went over Nagasaki. It was cloudy, and they were going to go against regulations and do a radar drop, but just at the last minute, the clouds opened up, and they bombed Nagasaki. I think it was almost a mile off target, which is why Nagasaki was not completely destroyed. It probably would have brought more destruction than Hiroshima if it had been on target. Incidentally, it was found that Nagasaki was the site of a prisoner of war camp that held some U.S. soldiers, and it was asked that it be taken off the list of targets, and the reply that was received back from the people in charge simply said, "Targets previously arranged remain unchanged." And I think there was one survivor from the prisoner of war camp. On August 10th, the Japanese surrender with the condition that Emperor Hirohito be permitted to retain his throne. Incidentally, he is still in power. Of course, a new constitution in Japan. One more final thing that I want to read. The United States Strategic Bombing Survey Crews. This is a governmental group that was assigned to go into Japan in August after the war and see what sort of state Japan was in. And this is part of their summary. "Certainly prior to December 31st, 1945, and in all probability prior to November 1st, Japan would have surrendered even if the atomic bomb had not been dropped, even if Russia had not entered the war, even if the United States had not altered its demand for unconditional surrender, and even if no land invasion had not been planned or contemplated. So it's a governmental group going in after the war, clearly said that the bomb was not the deciding factor in ending the war. I think I'll cut off that. I've talked much too long and open it up for questions and comments. And if you first have questions about some of the historical aspects, fine. Later, I would like to get in, if people want to stay and talk about the implications for today in the arms race. Yeah?
Was Hiroshima a military target prior to the 9/11? I heard that it was like a original city. It had never been bombed.
It was one of the cities that had not been very much bombed, and that's why it became a target, because they wanted to measure the effect of the blast. And they specifically did not choose Tokyo, which had been damaged so much. But yeah, it had some a lot of military installations, but it obviously also civilian population. Incidentally, Kyoto was the primary target before Hiroshima, and Secretary of War Stimson asked that that be taken off the list because it has thousands and thousands of Buddhist and Shinto shrines and is the old capital of Japan and the cultural center. And Stimson thought that the public opinion would go against the United States if we bombed a city like Kyoto, so it was changed to Hiroshima.
What was the official rationale for a second bomb being dropped so quickly within 3 days? All the Hiroshima bombing effect obviously was being assessed, and what's the rationale for the immediate?
Again, there are a number of different estimations. I think the fact that the Soviet Union declared war the day before, and that the Truman administration just got caught up in this drive to end the war, and did not wait. I think that it's because there were two bombs available. If there had been three bombs, I think we would have dropped three. But there were only two bombs available. In fact, the second bomb was supposed to be ready on August 12th, and they sped it up so that it was ready on August 9th. They worked through the night the next 3 days. Yeah.
Has had the war pretty much come to a standstill at that point? In other words, were the body count of American soldiers being brought home down to a low point at that point, or were we experiencing an awful lot of American soldiers still being killed on the islands at that time? And that was maybe one of the threats,
stop it. That I don't know the official counts. I know that there was not any major land invasion at that time, no major battles. It was mostly a sea blockade and then aerial bombing, and I'm sure there were some casualties from the aerial bombing, although the reports indicate that Japan was just, in terms of the anti-aircraft, was not at all powerful anymore. But I'm sure there were some casualties, and that's part of the worry of the Truman administration, that we have to end this as soon as possible.
The Japanese were still bombing us.
Yeah.
I was there.
Okay. They still had an air force. I don't know how strong it was. Again,
it was powerful where it was being used.
Okay. Okay, that's helpful. Yeah.
That's a fine presentation, but I it's prepared. I'm speaking for a person that was in that area.
Mm-hmm.
I was there 40 years ago. And I'm not trying to justify anything we did during the war. War is awful. There are quite a number of people here that were in that war. I'm sitting next to one I discovered a while ago. War is still hell. Certainly was right. And I wouldn't want to defend the government at the time to the point of justifying what any country did. It's easy for someone that 40 years after the event to build a case. But when you're confronted with the situation, and having dealt, it appears that your report makes us bad guys, and we are bad guys. But we had a lot of trouble. I remember, a lot of people here remember Pearl Harbor. We remember what Japan was doing at the time. Mm-hmm. We were trying to negotiate some sort of a peace when their representatives were here. And it didn't work. And I, from what I saw, and I went to Japan on an LST, and I entered Yokohama, and it was devastated. Mm. It was burned up. Thousands of people were killed. I don't know how many. It doesn't matter, you know, too much how you, if you're going to kill a person in a war or what, the way you do it isn't the important thing. The fact that you do it at all is the bad part. And looking at your calendar of events here, Okinawa happened after VJ Day, right? And a lot of these battles happened after VJ Day.
And I VE Day.
VE Day. VE Day. Excuse me. I dismantled a lot of guns that were in place in the cliffs of around Yokohama. I have burned a lot of rifles, and I have one in my garage at home. If anybody wants it, they can have it. I never unpacked it. I don't know why I sent it back, but you know.
Let me clarify one point, because sure. I think that's helpful. I don't mean at all to only criticize the Truman administration or the military. I think that public opinion was very much in support of the dropping of that bomb. And there was very little outcry of the other kinds of bombings that were done earlier in the war, the civilian bombings of Tokyo, the fire bombings. There was very little public outcry. So I don't think that we can get off blaming the Truman administration. I think that, you know, all of us, whether we're in the war or not, are guilty people. So it's not my intention at all to lay blame on people who were in World War II or any of that. But I do think it's appropriate to take a look at history 4 years back, look what we did, yes. And now look forward. How do we see that, and how do we proceed with the recognition that we have done wrong?
No, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I had one other experience that was rather vivid. Those of you that were in the back in the 40s were in the service. While we were here in the States, I hope this is a good analogy. I hope it works. We were required to carry gas masks in training and all over the country. Well, we shipped overseas with our gas masks and our barracks bag and our M1s. Got overseas. The first thing we were told to, we turned in two things. One was our mattress pad, which we'd have no use for, and the other was our gas mask, which the Army says you'll have no use for this. I would hope that our knowledge and keeping the war and its devastation, the atomic bomb, and I think you're doing a good thing there. I don't mean you, I think all of us who see some evil in this. Let's hope and pray that maybe we did not have any gas warfare, and we were loaded with the junk, and we're loaded with atomic bombs now. Maybe there's this, maybe this will work. I don't know. I hope it does.
I hope you're right. I just heard on the radio a little few days ago or last week that the president or that the Congress had approved now money for chemical weapons. Is that, did anyone else hear that?
Yeah. Including nerve gas.
Nerve gas, yeah. There's a question back here. Thank you.
Basically going to say about the same thing that you said, that I think the importance of this discussion, this talk, is not to vindicate ourselves or condemn ourselves for what happened, but to learn from history and realize what happened and the implication of what happened, that it isn't just the loss of 100,000 lives, maybe saving a million lives, but it's the implication is that we opened the door to the total destruction of our world. And
how can we learn what happened, what went through these people's minds to allow this to occur or cause it to occur and prevent that?